live to live righteously.
It's time for another episode of The Cultural Hall. It's episode number 306, wherein I will be joined by Jane Clayson Johnson. The name sounds familiar. Do you know? Do you place it? She's written a book, Silent Souls Weeping, that is available through Deseret Book. Thank you for being here, Jane Clayson Johnson.
Thank you, Richie. Episode 306. Yeah? I'm honored. New favorite number.
It's the luckiest number of all of them. It's something in astrological signs.
Okay, I'm with you. That's good.
And we know that the stars have aligned, because peel back the curtain, we had a little bit of problem connecting, so I appreciate you being patient through all that.
You fixed it. Your masterful technological abilities made it work, made it happen. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for having me. I really appreciate your interest in this important topic, and being able to have this conversation with you is important. So thank you.
I'm definitely excited to talk about Silent Souls Weeping, talk about depression, talk about the stigma around it, talk about your experience with it. But set the table for people who may not know who Jane Clayson Johnson is.
Oh, well, I'm a mom, and I'm a wife, and I'm a lover of cooking and all things sort of comfortable and homey. In a previous life, some people may remember, I worked at KSL Television for many years, and then went on to work at ABC News in Los Angeles, where I was a correspondent for World News Tonight. I traveled the world for ABC as a correspondent, went to Jakarta, Indonesia, to cover the fall of the Suharto government. I was in Kosovo, Macedonia, refugee crisis after the NATO airstrikes in Kosovo. Just did a lot of international reporting. Then went to CBS News in New York, where I co-hosted the early show with Brian Gumbel for 3 years, and just had a front row seat to history. We were on the air during 9/11, just interviewed presidents and prime ministers and Hollywood stars and everyone in between, and just had a really extraordinary experience. There, and then moved to Boston.
I love that you sort of couch it, and I appreciate that you did that, right? Like, I'm just a mom. I just, I love...
Not just a mom. I am a mom.
I'm sorry.
A mother.
You're right.
I wrote the book on that. I wrote the book on that, Richie.
But certainly that you have other things in addition to, and let me correct myself, not just a mom, but that you are a mom in addition to all of those other things. Is there one, and I'm sure that people have asked you this question, so cliche as it is there one moment in all of that, if we can group it in a non-realistic word of newsing, is there anything in all of your newsing that really sticks out to you?
Oh, goodness. When I'm asked this question, so many things flow through my mind. I just was able to interview, the biggest newsmakers of the day. It was... the Secretary of State, one minute it was an author, next it was, a famous actor or whatever, after that. It was just a constant flow of just really interesting people who had accomplished really, extraordinary things. I think my most favorite interviews were always with those people who were not particularly famous, mm-hmm. who had done something heroic or courageous and had... overcome something in their lives. And so those to me were the most interesting interviews, because I just connected with those kinds of people. And I think that's why this book was so interesting for me, is that I was able to connect with so many different kinds of people who had overcome very difficult things in their lives and were working on themselves in a way that was really just inspiring to me. So
almost like an everyday hero.
Because
you interview those people that are, famous for whatever reason,
yep.
and they have their
yep.
talking points, and they have the things that they'll talk about, and they'll have the things that they won't talk about. And to your point, leading towards this book, where I think you speak with over 150 different people.
Correct. Right.
Some of these are people who are not polished, who don't have talking points, and who... are just sharing their experience with you, and in their way of surviving sometimes or just making it, are their very own heroes.
That's exactly right. You know, after I had been through my own experience with depression, I started to realize after talking with people what a significant problem and challenge it is for many who are struggling and suffering and so often in silence. And so I decided that I would put my journalism skills to use and start interviewing people about it. I just wasn't talking about it anymore with them. I asked to interview them, and I interviewed more than 150 people over the course of 3 years and heard their stories and started and just asked them about their experience. And what happened was remarkable. People opened up to me in a way that many hadn't opened up to before. And I chronicled, documented all of those conversations and sort of drew a line through what I heard. And that's how my book was born.
Well, I want to back it up then, because I, you know, that's what you did with the book, these stories, these experiences, but you're coming at it from a very personal experience. So if I may, can we talk about your experience with depression?
Sure.
So how, when, where, what did it feel like? What were the, you know, give me it all.
Well, you know, I chose to write about my experience very honestly and openly at the very first chapter of my book. Because I felt like if I was going to invite others to be more open about their experience with depression, I had to be more open about my own. And so I talk about, you know, my experience, which was very unexpected and quite harrowing. I had never experienced depression before. I had had bouts of what I call situational sadness over the years, you know, but
Things like heartbreak or something that didn't go well, that kind of thing?
Well, no, you know, just regular experiences in life that we all go through, but nothing that a good, you know, cry or two or three couldn't overcome and get over. I mean, I could always move away from my feelings eventually, if not immediately. And then when I experienced this depression, this clinical depression, it just felt so different. And I couldn't understand what was happening. That was so confusing, as I just didn't know because it was so foreign to me. So when it just started descending upon me, I felt, well, what would I say? I felt ashamed because I thought maybe I had brought something, I had done something to cause this, to bring this on. I was like, well, what's wrong? I have everything that I need right here. I have a wonderful family, and I have great kids that I've always wanted, and I just had just confusion because I didn't know what was causing it, and so you know it went on for a while, and I didn't speak about it with anyone because I was so embarrassed, and I just felt so ashamed about it and confused. So I think that's a common feeling among people, is that, you know, they don't quite know what it is. And if they do, sometimes I think depression is easy to hide. You know, you can show up at church and show up with friends here or there and, you know, kind of put on a happy face and go through the motions and then come home and fall into bed for the rest of the day. So
talk about the embarrassed and ashamed. I think that's sort of an interesting part of it. Do you feel like that's because you are such a public figure?
Oh no. Mm-mm. No, there were this was one of the main themes actually that came out of my interviews, was this notion of the stigma associated with depression. Over and over, people describe to me a sense of embarrassment or even shame attached to a mental health diagnosis, and I certainly felt the same way. You know, I felt like I was in a sack, and it was tied at the top, and I couldn't get out of it. You know, I just felt like I was trapped. I felt like I was sinking, drowning, choking. I mean, all of these just really difficult. It was so physical, you know, it was just so physical. And the darkness, you know, just feeling like there was no hope, no, no hope for anything ever again, and that I might never be myself again. You know, those are the emotions that come with depression.
I love the physical description of being in a sack that you can't get out of. How were you able to get out of it? Like, what was it that broke the sack open, or that allowed you to have a conversation, or what was that experience?
Yeah, so I wrote about this in the book. I talked very openly about sort of what had happened and what was happening in my mind, and how I felt like I, you know, just in my mind I was planning my funeral. I mean, I didn't have a plan necessarily or a mechanism for making that happen. I just was in a deep clinical depression, and I wanted to just fall asleep and fade away. And so this went on for a long time, and finally my husband stepped in, and over the course of an experience, you know, she just took me to two doctors, and I started to understand that what was happening to me in this experience was an illness. It had nothing to do with something that I had done. It wasn't a personal failing on my part. It was a clinical illness, and I started to come out of it when I did cognitive behavioral therapy and started to take medication for a time. So, you know, treatment for depression works. Treatment is essential, but sometimes we can't recognize that we need it. And so I was really blessed to have someone in my life that helped me through that. And I think everyone needs that. And I think that's a really important message in this book, is that treatment works. It's really important to have someone that can help you. And sometimes it's hard to reach out, but when you do, you know, help and hope can come.
I want to take a break for a quick second. And when we come back, I want to talk about, you mentioned failing. I thought that was kind of an interesting thing. And I also want to talk about the stigma around mental health, mental illness, depression, all the stigma around these things. We'll come back and we'll do that in the second block of the Cultural Hall. Hey, you guys, I want to talk to you about bestdjinutah.com. Why, that's the company that I have started for doing my DJing weddings and live events. Whatever you need, I am your guy to do it. So whether you're a lifer or a convert to this podcast show, or you just happen to be listening for the first time, if you are in need of a wedding DJ or an MC for your event, or just a DJ for your business opening, go to bestdjinutah.com. Now, I know it says Utah, but guess what? If you want me to come to your event and you're not in Utah, I'll do that too. You're going to have to pay for me to be there, but I'm more than willing to do that as well. It's bestdjinutah.com. Emails there, phone numbers there. Would love to hear from you and then help you make your event that much better. Look forward to hearing from you, and thank you for supporting the Cultural Hall podcast. But it's a show. You knew that.
Imagine running a small business today. It's challenging. Imaging and internet presence is an absolute must. Even with that, you're still a small star in a bright cyber universe. Now, imagine you have someone who understands how to get your site designed for your talents and then easily searched by potential clients. Imagine Lennon Design. Whether it's strictly a website or a whole package of logo creation, advertising media, and promotional materials, Lennon Design is your partner in business. They'll test the boundaries of their imagination to create something unique for you. When you need creative, affordable design, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
Back here in the second block of the Cultural Hall, we're talking with Jane Clayson Johnson, author of the book Silent Souls Weeping. And if you love what you're hearing here, you like more of this kind of stuff, you can always email us guest suggestions, contact@theculturalhall.com. And if you'd like to become a Patreon subscriber, you can do so by going to patreon.com/The Cultural Hall. Now, Jane, right before we went into break there, you talked a little bit about that feeling of failing, or sort of some of the stigmas that exist around depression. Well, you're just not praying hard enough. You've obviously
Correct.
Done something wrong and offended God, and that's why you're feeling the way that you do. You need to pick yourself up by the bootstraps. Go serve someone. Mm-hmm. All of those things that we certainly hear within our faith. Let's talk about them.
Yeah, no, good. Thank you for asking the question, because I think this is a really, really important point. I heard over and over again from people this sense of embarrassment or shame, not just from a mental health diagnosis, but from because of the medication that's prescribed or the therapy that's required for treatment. I heard so many times, I've never talked about this with anyone, or my parents don't even know this, or I can't believe I'm telling you this. So we've made a little bit of progress over the last few years, but stigma is still the number one reason people do not reach out for help, even in times of crisis. And it's not just the stigma from the disease itself, it's the byproducts of depression or mental illness as well. It's missing a semester of school because you've been hospitalized or you're in bed. It's being out of step socially or employment-wise. Mm-hmm. You know, so there are a lot of reasons why the stigma and shame exist, but whether it's self-induced or culturally imposed, it is unhealthy and unhelpful. And I think part of the problem, Richie, is that depression has for so long been perceived as some sort of character flaw, you know, something that we can control or overcome if we just tried harder, right? Mm-hmm. And I really think it's important to recognize that just like any other physical illness, clinical depression requires treatment. It is not the result of personal inadequacy. It is not a black mark on your character. Nobody thinks that battling cancer or diabetes or heart disease or any other serious illness is a matter of just pulling yourself up and going at it alone. You're not going to fix this or snap out of it with work and discipline. Treatment is required. And so that's why in this book, Silent Souls Weeping, I've tried so hard to be open and honest, and why so many other people have tried to be open and honest in their struggles, because the more we can sort of pull back the blinds and open the window on this conversation and turn it from a whisper to a song, the more we're going to help people.
I have two different ways I want to go right now, and for whatever reason, while you were talking, what popped into my mind was you mentioned over the last few years we were really starting to make some headwind, right? Take some legs with this stuff. And I remember, I think it was in 2013, Elder Holland speaking at General Conference about this.
Yes.
The talk which I'm speaking of.
Of course, I quote it many times in my book. I mean, I think that was a watershed moment, Richie, for many, many members of our church, who just felt like for the first time someone had taken this topic and personalized it. And Elder Holland stood up there so vulnerable and talked about his own experience. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that that was a moment where people just sort of felt relief.
Yeah.
and it inspired me, which is why I quote Elder Holland so often in my book. But I do think it leads to another important part of this conversation, which is what depression does to feelings of the spirit. And next to stigma, that was the next most talked about issue in the 150 interviews that I did over the course of 3 years for this book. I can totally understand when people say, when I am depressed, I do not feel the spirit.
Yeah.
I just don't feel God's love, because that's what happened to me. I was doing everything right. I was praying and reading my scriptures and going to the temple, but I just didn't feel anything. It was like the most important part of my soul had been cut out of me. And so I think as members of the church, we really struggle to understand this. And I think a lot of people, it's been a source of just of real pain. Because why? What have I done wrong? Why doesn't God love me? Why don't I feel his love? As members of the church, we're trying to fit this disease manifest through sorrow into a religion centered on a plan of happiness,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So depression is a disease. It is not a spiritual deficit. Depression is a disease. It is not a spiritual deficit. And since this book has been published, I cannot tell you how many people I have heard from who have reached out to me and said, yes, that is exactly what happened to me. And I thought I'd done something wrong. You know, we grow up in the church and we think if we're following the commandments, you know, then you're living by the Spirit and you're happy. And if you're dark or sad or not social or whatever, then you've done something wrong and you need to repent, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, depression is like any other physical illness. You wouldn't sit in the corner, Richie, and pray your heart disease away. you would pray and you would go to the cardiologist. And the same is true with depression. And so to me, the loss of the spirit is the most distressing part of depression and why getting treatment is so critical.
I love the visual of me trying to pray away a heart disease, right?
Right? Yeah.
No, I'm not going to go to the doctor. I think that if I just right. Pray hard
if
enough.
If I just try harder, if I just pray more, if I just serve more, this heart disease will go away, right? No. We would never do that. Why would we do the same thing with depression?
You know, so much of this depression, of the stigma around depression, of the things that we're talking about, it seems to me that it's so culturally impacted, right? Like we almost have the perfect recipe for not helping people in this kind of situation, right? I feel like altruistically, that we could. You talked about your husband, that he was there, and hopefully within our congregations or certainly within our own families, we have those people there. But we also have very much that idea of, like, the things you talked about, picking yourself up by the bootstraps, pray a little harder, need to go to the temple a little bit more. And then also with that, an unavailability of being authentic. Right. I have to be. There is this mold that I have to fit, and I need to look this way, and my kids need to look this way. And we do it to each other to the point that we can't be vulnerable, or the choice to be vulnerable seems nearly impossible.
Right. I write an entire chapter on toxic perfectionism because it came up over and over again as a contributor to depression. The scripture in Matthew 5, we put that on steroids, and we misconstrue the admonition to be therefore perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. We see that word perfect in there, and we think, oh, okay, I got to be perfect. I have to be without flaw. I have to be without mistake, And since I can't do that, no one can do that, I have to give at least the illusion that I'm perfect. But when we try to live up to this unattainable standard, we are not authentic. And that is not what God has asked of us. And I talk very openly and very specifically about how toxic perfectionism is detrimental to good mental health. It's really, really a big issue. And I think especially among women. I mean, I'm a recovering perfectionist myself. And so it was not a surprise to me that I would hear from many women, especially, who talk about this issue and how they struggle with it. So being more open about it, I think we can kind of bust the stigma, Let's bust the stigma together right here, right now, and talk about these things and realize that none of us is perfect and we don't need to be right here, right now.
I think about that, and I think of, and this seems to be either the hot topic or buzzwords or, whatever we want to label that as, but social media and toxic perfectionism are one in the same to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, social media certainly fuels it, with these carefully filtered and curated feeds. We're showing the happiest and prettiest and shiniest events in our lives. But when we try to hide every flaw in appearance, in academics, in business, in parenting, in lesson planning, in fitness, I mean, you name it, in every area of life, to present this sort of put-together, successful exterior, again, it is detrimental to good mental health. And so that's an important chapter in my book, just to try to bust that stigma. There was a study published in the American Psychological by the American Psychological Association talking about toxic perfectionism and reported that the link between perfectionism and suicide is stronger than previously believed and distressingly under-recognized. So again, this feeling of living an authentic life leads to despair. Imposterism is what the study says. So again, being aware of it, trying to overcome it, trying to just be more real, be more authentic. That's a good first step.
People that are listening to this, there might be those that are finding themselves in that, that they're depressed, that they have clinical depression, or, as you mentioned, they could just be finding themselves in situational sadness. What kind of advice do you give to those people, to people who maybe haven't gone and spoken even with their spouse or with someone in their family, someone that's close to them that are listening to this and going, ah, boy, this is me. And let me ask a follow-up to that before I let you free on this. Because I think the thing for me, there have been times where I've never been, to a doctor to be clinically, told that that's the case. But there's a certain amount of fear for me receiving that label, right? And everything that goes with, and not understanding that, and kind of following that process. So speak to me and to anyone else.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think again, let's stigma bust here a little bit, Richie, and
please.
being afraid to receive that label. What are you afraid of? You know, would you be afraid for liver disease diagnosis? Would you be afraid to receive a diagnosis of diabetes? No. I mean, I think that that's what we have to sort of get to, the nugget, the heart of this, you know. And when we start to understand and we start to educate ourselves about the problem, about the illness, about the byproducts of it, then we start to better understand it. I mean, I want to open a dialogue. I want to start these stories flowing in families and in church communities and in neighborhoods and classrooms and hope that we can speak more freely about depression, that in sharing our stories that we'll feel kind of the judgment slip away. If there's anything that I heard over the last 3 years of writing this book, it is that people wanted to be heard. Mm-hmm. They desperately wanted validation for difficult experiences. And I think no matter which side of the depression coin you're on, if you are depressed, if you love someone who is depressed, because that's a totally different conversation and another important chapter of my book, that, you know, once you start to understand it and have empathy, then you'll understand that this is my favorite quote, one of my favorite quotes from my book, from an interviewee that I spoke with, who said, "Depression thrives in secrecy, but shrinks in empathy." Depression thrives in secrecy, but shrinks in empathy. Let's have more empathy. Let's have more understanding. Let's have more outreach. I talk very openly, not about mental health anymore, Richie. I talk about brain health. Just like we talk about heart health so openly and freely, I talk about brain health. The brain is just another organ of the body, and brain health is just as important as any other mechanism of health in our body, right? So I think that helps to overcome the stigma, but more than anything else, I think just jumping right into our stories and our experiences is the most important thing we can do.
I think it's so funny that I walked into the very thing we were talking about, that I'm saying, I'm hesitant to talk about that mental health for me. And I mean, we don't know each other more than the minutes that we've shared doing this, but I am someone where people will come to me and they'll go, you know who will tell me exactly how it is, how he feels, what he's thinking. Richie will do that. And it's so funny that when it comes to this thing for me, like I just kind of go, can we divert? Can we talk about something else? Can we make a joke? I'd like to do something else besides talk about this with me.
Right. And so my book is for you. I'm really serious about that. This book is for you because I think that you will have a better understanding of the experience of depression from many, many different perspectives. Like I said, I tried to draw a line through what I heard. I had an open slate starting this book. And after people started telling me their stories, dozens and dozens of them, I started to see themes and I started to write about the experience of these people, whether it's postpartum depression, whether it's kids and teens who suffer, whether it's missionaries who come home early because of a mental health diagnosis, whether it's toxic perfectionism or stigma, or the suicide, the epidemic of suicide. I have a chapter on that. All of these experiences will help you understand what it's like to live with someone who is depressed. And so someone who's never experienced it yourself, from the outside looking in, you can have a new perspective and an understanding that will help you as you interact with others in your life.
I want to take a break one last time, and then we'll come back. I want to talk about some of just how the book came about. I know we've talked around that, but I've got a few questions with that. And then three questions that we ask everyone who step into the cultural hall. We'll do that in the third block, coming back.
Hey, this is Dan, the Laptop Man from PC Laptops. Are you experiencing panic attacks, nausea, or diarrhea? Is your computer not turning on? Is it running super slow? Is your internet crawling? Or is it just randomly crashing? You could be suffering from ICS, Irritable Computer Syndrome. I want you to ask yourself, when was the last time you had your PC cleaned? Over time, Windows, updates, spyware, malware, and dangerous viruses will make your computer run like crap. You need to bring in your laptop or desktop PC, no matter what brand it is, and let me run a 100% free virus scan, malware, and spyware scan on your computer. Don't wait and risk losing everything. Now, why are we doing this for free? Because we want to impress you so much that if you or any of your friends or family need a computer, service, or phone repair, you come to PC Laptops first. Get into any one of our locations right now or check us out at PCLaptops.com. PC Laptops, where computers start at $7.99. PC Laptops, we love you.
Here in the third block of the Cultural Hall, Jane Clayson Johnson on the phone with us. So you talk about that you interviewed over 150 people for the making of Silent Souls Weeping. How did you get those people?
Well, I'm a journalist by training, and so for 20, 25 years, this has been what I have done. And so this was really a journalistic exercise for me. I mean, I started calling a few people, a few experts whom I had been referred to, and I asked them if they knew, you know, someone that I could speak with, or if they knew, you know, a professional that would be interesting or had some important research. And I just started calling around, and I just started talking to people. And before I knew it, I had dozens and dozens and dozens of interviews, and I had quite literally thousands of pages of transcripts from all these interviews in a huge iCloud file. And then started kind of drawing a line through what I heard and putting these experiences, categorizing them into chapters, and then writing the stories coupled with the latest research on depression and mental illness. And so that's what this book is about.
Were there people who said, "No way, Jane"?
So it's such a great question. So every person that I spoke with, I wrote up their stories, and before the book was published, I sent them their stories just to make sure that I got everything right. Mm-hmm. You know, there were little tweaks here and there, little facts. I wanted to be completely, correct. And so every person was able to see their story. And of all of the stories that are in the book, dozens and dozens of them, only one person told me that they didn't want me to use their story. Mm. And so I think that goes to the point of people recognizing how widespread the problem is and wanting to use their experience to help someone else. I think when you can use a difficult or challenging trial in your life, if you will, and when you can use that and turn it around and learn from it and help somebody else overcome it, or at least struggle through it together, I think it brings meaning, you know? And I think a lot of people that I interviewed felt that their experience had meaning because they were able to share it and help someone else through it.
You talk about authenticity quite a bit. We've mentioned it a bunch. So vital. So maybe I'm just repeating what you've said. That's something that has stuck to me as we have talked is the need, the importance for people to be authentic. You don't have to be, you know, God doesn't want you to be anything else but what you are. People should be the same way. And if there are people in your life that want you to be something else, maybe you don't need those people so much in your life.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And it goes back to the point of toxic perfectionism. You know, the study that I looked at from the American Psychological Association, the one I referred to earlier, talked about the link between that and suicide. And maybe I could just use this opportunity to talk a little bit about the epidemic of suicide, because the statistics are just heartbreaking. 28% increase in the suicide rate in the United States just over the last 20 years. In Utah, where, you know, suicide is the leading cause of death for young people ages 15 to 24. One in four teenagers in Utah say that they have recently seriously considered suicide. One in four. And Utah ranks fifth in the nation in suicide deaths. Our LGBTQ plus youth who are rejected by their parents are at special risk for suicide. They are more than 8 times more likely than non-rejected youth to attempt it. They also report high levels of depression at 6 times the rate of non-rejected youth. So we've got to talk about this suicide epidemic. When it's the leading cause of death for young people, ages 15 to 24, the conversations have to change. And I would just say quickly that the notion that talking to someone about their feelings of depression and certainly about suicide, the notion that talking about those feelings may lead them to act on them has been debunked by a number of studies, as well as by those who have attempted suicide and are now trying to heal. So talking about suicide can actually help prevent it. And part of my mission with this book is to try to shine a light on the need to have these important conversations.
So as we talk about the youth and suicide and stuff like that, I think these very things that you've talked about are important, right? People being able to have someone that loves and cares for them, the ability to feel like they're being their authentic selves. And I think some of that is that they don't really know who they are. They're trying to figure themselves out as well. What advice can you give? You mentioned at the very beginning, and I made the mistake of saying just a mother. Let me reiterate, a mother. but as you've had conversations with your own children, what have been those valuable mm-hmm. things that people that are listening can do with either their own children or the children whose lives they're able to impact?
Another good question. I think that it's unwise and potentially dangerous to hide our mental health struggles from our children. Because what is that saying to them about what we're going through? What does that say to them when they have struggles with mental health, when they need to get help, when they need to reach out? You know, if we're keeping some sort of secret here that we can't talk about. So we've been very open about this, and my children were really my biggest motivation for writing this book. The dedication of my book, the dedication page reads, "So my children will understand." You know, I have great kids. I wanted them to understand what depression looked like in our family, and I wanted them to not be afraid to be able to reach out for help if they ever struggled with the same thing.
And I think that extends to just greater parenting in general, right? We've talked in the admitting if there are mental health struggles that you have with your kids. But I think like just being able to admit to a kid, hey, you know what? When you said this, I overreacted and that was a wrong thing that I did. Like just being able to say, hey, as a parent, I'm not perfect and it's okay to not be perfect to our children. It's a game changer.
No, I think that's exactly right. You know, I think the statistics are, I have them here somewhere if I could find them quickly. The number of teenagers that will struggle, 20% of teenagers will experience depression before adulthood. Mm-hmm. That's 1 in 5, jeez, right? 20% of teenagers. I got a great email just a few days ago from a woman who shared with me how she had reached out to a 14-year-old girl who she knew was struggling with depression. This girl wouldn't go to school. She would barely leave her darkened room. And this woman had the courage to share her own experience as a teenager with depression that started in 7th grade. It culminated a year later when her mother came home from work to find her huddled under her bed making a concrete plan to end her life. Mm. So sharing that story, hearing how this woman is able to get help after that dark and desperate moment, seeing how this woman is now a happy, functioning adult really helped this 14-year-old recognize that she's not alone, right? That others have been through this. And because she was willing to be vulnerable and open up and share that, a connection was made. And that's a really important source of healing, not just for that 14-year-old girl, but for the woman who shared her story too. So it goes both ways. And I, you know, you can hear it in my voice, Richie, I'm just really passionate about this. I'm passionate about changing the conversation, you know, about getting these stories flowing in all circumstances. Because again, that's where healing and hope starts. That's where it begins.
Do you have a project coming up next? I know you're certainly telling everyone about Silent Souls Weeping, but what is coming up next for you, or are you just enjoying this ride?
Oh, you know, I have to tell you, I put everything that I have into this book. It felt like drinking from a fire hose. I mean, I had so much information coming at me, and really the level of the emotional input into this book. I mean, I felt such responsibility for the stories that were shared with me. In every story, I heard pain and vulnerability and loneliness, but I also saw hope and love and life, and I really wanted to focus on that. So this book about depression is not depressing. I can promise you that. It is not depressing. It is uplifting and hopeful. And so I put everything I have into it. It's like having a baby, you know, you hear that moment and that baby comes out and you think, I will never do that again. That was awful. That was so hard. I'm thinking that right now I'm just, I feel like I've done something hopefully that will help people. Hopefully that people will feel like the conversation can be different now because of what they've read.
It absolutely will, and I realize that what I've also done is in your having a baby analogy, what I've essentially done is you've just had a baby, and I said, "Hey, when are you going to have another one?" I've become that guy.
That's all right. I don't have anything else on the horizon. I really I may stick with this for a while. I really have enough material for a second book just on this alone, and I feel like it's so needed. I just felt like I could lend my voice and my platform to people who didn't have that platform, so that we could try to see if we can do better, you know, try to see if we can reach out and be more vulnerable. And I was willing to do that in an effort to make that change.
People can get the book at DeseretBook.com. It's our good friends over there. It's called Silent Souls Weeping. You can get a hardcover. You can get the ebook. And are you reading the audiobook? Is it you reading?
I did read the audiobook. Uh-huh. Oh, cool. I did. It's my voice, and I read it in the studio, and thank you. Yeah. It's a wonderful experience, actually.
It's a great way to experience stuff too. I love the audiobooks so much because I'm not a person who finds himself available to just sit and read, but you know, I can put you in my ears while I'm at the gym and then I can read the things that I've always wanted to, but just can't sit still to do.
Yeah, or in the car or wherever you may be, cooking or whatever. Yeah, no, thank you, Richie. That's very nice of you. I do appreciate you being willing to tackle this and to have me on. I really appreciate it very much.
Yeah, it's important, and I know from hearing you express in a different interview, it affects everyone, right? Maybe not us. Maybe not us. Individually, maybe I don't struggle with depression, but I can give you a list of people that I know that do and that I'm trying to be better for and there for and help, you know, decrease that stigma.
You know, I gave a talk the other night and I, at the very beginning of the talk, I asked the people in a room, in a large ballroom, if you've suffered with depression or if you know someone who has, would you please stand up? And I was expecting, you know, maybe half, 60% of the room to stand up. 90% of the room stood up. And I said, I'm standing with you. I'm standing with you. Everybody has a story. Everybody has been impacted. And whether they talk about it or not, everybody knows somebody, if not themselves.
We have three questions that we ask everyone who steps into the cultural hall. I'll ask those of you right now. The first question is, do you have a calling? And if so, what is it?
I do have a calling. I am in the Young Women's Presidency. I serve the young women in our ward.
If you could pick a calling for yourself, either one that exists or make one up, and it can be whatever, what would you pick?
So it's so funny. I had the same calling in four wards over 12 years. I was the gospel doctrine teacher. That was my only calling over 12 years in four wards. And I loved that calling. I really, really loved that calling. But my very favorite calling is primary chorister.
I knew it.
Primary chorister.
I knew you would be a primary chorister person. I could just tell.
Yeah, it's the best. It is the best.
I I would do it except for the kids. I'm not to the point where I like young kids. Like the idea
of
teaching songs and singing for an hour, I'm on board. Costumes, you bet. If I could just remove the kids out of the primary chorister part of it, I'd be on board for that.
All right. I'm not sure that's going to happen, but okay.
No, but it's a made-up calling, so it can happen within the,
rules
of that question. And then the last one that we ask everyone is, what is your favorite part of your faith?
My favorite part of my faith. Well, I have to say that I choose to believe. I think these days especially, it can be very easy to talk your way out of the gospel. But I choose to believe because I have seen the good that the gospel can do. I see how it has changed my life. I see it how it has changed my husband's life. My husband is a convert to the church, joined the church in his late 30s, right before I met him. I've seen how the gospel has changed my children's lives. My husband had 3 children when I met him, and they were young, they were little, and I see how the gospel has changed their lives. They have since joined our church, and 2 have been married in the temple, and we have 3 little grandbabies. And so, you know, the good that the gospel can do is profound, and it's life-changing. And so I choose to see the good. I choose to see what is uplifting, and there is a lot of good.
Jane, I appreciate you taking a few minutes. The book is called Silent Souls Weeping. You can get it at Deseret Book. Make sure that you let them know that you heard about it on the Cultural Hall. We hope that this episode has nourished and strengthened your body, that if you are not healthy enough to listen this week, that you will be healthy enough to listen next week, and that when the time comes, you will be able to travel home in safety. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back
That's
row
good.
Of the Cultural Hall.
I love it. Richie, thank you.
Thank you.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat.